Okay, everyone. So again, just coming back to the most basic principles of meditation practice. And to just remember the most basic things are the most important ones. If you get the basic things right, then things tend to fall into place by themselves. It's just finding that nice balance of the body, where the body is not important in any way whatsoever, whether because it's painful or you are indulging, all of that, put that aside. And then find that ease of the mind in the middle, the ease of the mind where it's not stressed, but it's just enjoying this beautiful opportunity of sitting down, just enjoying the peace, the good company, and this wonderful situation of being in the presence of the Buddha. And as you start to enjoy the meditation, then that is where mindfulness can be found. And it is always useful to turn your attention to whatever delight there is here, the freedom from burdens of having nothing to do in the whole world, just sitting peacefully, watching your breath, enjoying the good company. Just that liberation from burdens is such a wonderful thing. The simplicity of sitting down in meditation practice, just being aware of the present. What a wonderful thing that is. And if you do find that the mind wanders off into the future or whatever, remember that that thinking about the future does not make any difference for the future. That is not where the future is created. The future is created now by being peaceful in the present. This is where you need to put your attention. All the other stuff is a waste of time. And then again, just wait for the breath to emerge by itself. Don't go to the breath, but allow the breath to come to you. No willpower, no doing, just allowing the process to unfold. And when you come to the breath, make sure you have a beautiful appreciation of the breath as a companion on the spiritual path, as something that has supported you throughout life, a sense of gratitude, a sense of ease, a sense of friendship, allowing the breath to come and go as it pleases, no force, and then just enjoying the path forward. And it is important that the breath is delightful and comfortable. If it does become uncomfortable in any way, take a step back. Remember to see the breath in a way like you are watching a sunset, something that is naturally attractive, but not something you are trying to control. To stay with the breath as you're staying with the sunset, just enjoying, just delighting, but not controlling. So once again, coming close to the end, and before you come to the end, just very briefly review your meditation. And if you do feel more at ease, peaceful, mindful, whatever it is, again, try to understand the causality, understand why that is the case. Okay, yeah, everyone. So, welcome back again. David, can we try the projector, see if it works? That'd be possible. I'm sure it's probably quite easy to turn it on, but I thought I might leave it to you. So let's see if I can connect up this computer. Aha, look at that. Wow. That's pretty cool. So that's for later on, so we can, when we do the chanting, you can see the
chanting.
Excellent. Okay. We will leave it off for now, but okay. We can just turn it off for now. I just wanted to check if it works. Great. Thank you. Trying to turn it off. Okay, excellent. Well done then. All right. Okay, everyone, so let's get back to the questions again. Oi! Self-destruct. No. Okay. All right, so let's start again and see what we've got tonight. So, first one. Venerable Brahmali, my question revolves around the goal of the path and the meaning this brings to your life. It may take a little back and forth to get to the heart of it, though if you are open to that. And if so, there's perhaps time. If there is time, perhaps this could go last. All right, we can... Sure, now this is an important question, I think, very much so. So I'm very happy to do it last or, first or last, whatever. Maybe if you're asking for last, we'll just follow your request, yeah? Okay, next one. Bhante Ajahn. Can a uniting or an artist be a monk? An artist be a monk? And continue visiting or painting, writing and painting. A writer, oh, that's not what it is, writer or not. Continue writing or painting, if not for commercial gain, but for personal pleasure. Can you do that? Well, there's many things you can do, but should you do it is a different matter, right? So can you, should you, all of these things? It's kind of hard to know. I would say that... there are all kinds of monastics, and there are monastics who do artwork, who do writing. It depends a bit on what you would want to write. You know, are you going to write Dhamma books, or are you going to write novels, or are you going to write science fiction, or what exactly are you going to write? I mean, there are certain things you definitely should not write as a monk. You can probably imagine what some of those things might be. You know, so it really depends on what kind of writing you would do. There are, even Bhante Sujato, he recently published like a Dhamma novel. He likes to write. He's quite a skilled writer, and so it is not bad necessarily. Artistry, you know, it depends. You may find out that if you do become a monk, maybe you want to give it up. Maybe you don't want to do it anymore. It really depends on the situation. It's easy to think now, as a layperson, that you will want to continue in exactly the same way as a monastic, but maybe you want. You wouldn't want that. It's very hard to tell before.
Shouldn't write a love story.
Sorry?
Shouldn't write a love story.
Shouldn't write a love story, right. No, yeah, that, exactly, yeah. That's not recommended, because it tends to draw you in that direction, right? It's kind of your secret fantasies kind of coming out. So there is no absolutes in these things. Whatever. I'm not sure exactly why you're asking. Is it because you want to be a monk but you can't give up certain things? Is that the reason? Or a nun, maybe? Come to the monastery, check it out, stay for a while and see what happens. That's kind of what I would recommend. Whenever someone asks whether they should become a monk or a nun, what I usually recommend them to do, go to a few different monasteries. What you will find that monasteries are quite different. And the atmosphere that you find, some places you will enjoy, you feel at ease, you feel at home, you feel like it is for you. You feel that these are people you enjoy being with. Other places you may feel completely odd one out. It's like, what am I doing here? This doesn't fit at all. And it's a very important, I think it's far more important that you feel good in the monastery than you have some kind of intellectual idea that this is the right place for you. It has to feel good, it has to feel right. Otherwise, it's not going to be sustainable for you to stay in that place. So try a few different monasteries. Come down to Perth, come and visit us. Very hard to get a spot in our monastery, because, especially for people from overseas, because of the visa regulations, but come and stay anyway for a while, just to check it out. Try a few different places. And then see, what works for you, what doesn't work. That's the best thing to do. And then forget about the writing and painting for a while. We'll get back to that later on. Anyway, something like that. Okay. So, all right. Dear teacher, okay. What monasteries in Asia are open for lay Westerners to practice and volunteer work? Thank you. What monasteries in Asia... many monasteries are open, it's not that hard to find a monastery, but if you're going to go to a monastery, go to one that is inspiring, where you find that the teachings you get are inspiring and you feel like you are, in a good place. The monk I mentioned yesterday, Ajahn Ganha, go to his monastery here. It's a very beautiful place, and you really feel a lot of loving kindness and metta. You feel in the presence of this monk. He comes out usually every evening and he talks to the lay people, and if you're lucky, he will throw a few sweets at you. or other stuff. He throws other stuff as well. Actually, he's more gentle with the heavy stuff. But So go to a few places, feel them out, and feel what it feels like. Come to Bodhinyana Monastery. We can't really stay with us for long periods of time. We have limits because we have very limited space. But places like Ajahn Ganha's monastery is a place you can stay for a long time. That is really a good place. Other places, maybe places like Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's old monastery, probably a place you can stay for a long time. Sri Lanka, there are some very, very good monasteries in Sri Lanka as well. One of the famous monasteries in Sri Lanka called Na Uyena Monastery, part of the forest tradition in Sri Lanka, also very inspiring place, lots of good monks. We had some connections with that monastery. There are various options, Yeah. There's Pao Ok's monastery in Burma. That is a very famous monastery. Yeah, Pao Ok Sayadaw. There is a lay woman right here in America. She's in Silicon Valley, called Shaila Catherine. She's a Pao Ok Sayadaw disciple. She's very impressive. I went to her center when I was in the Bay Area 3 weeks ago. Shaila Catherine is her name, and she has actually written a book on the sutta that we did today. That certainly reminds me. We did the sutta today on the calming of thoughts. She has recently released a book, actually, on that one. So Pao Ok Sayadaw's monastery in Burma is maybe a place you can visit. So you just have to travel around a bit and see what happens. I'm not sure exactly. I haven't been to many of these places myself, so I can't really say, but they have a reasonably good reputation. So, all right, there you are here. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, what is the Pali word for restraint? It is sangvara, is the word for restraint. Sangvara. S-A-N-G-V-A-R-A. Sangvara. Is there a gentler alternative translation here? This is a thing that I have myself wondered about a long time, whether there is a gentler translation than restraint, because it does sound a little bit like you're using willpower. And I haven't really come up with anything satisfactory. It seems to mean something like that. So I think the problem is really in the interpretation. We just need to interpret in the right way. Maybe if you come up with a gentler term, please let me know, and I will start using that. But I haven't, so far, haven't really come across anything that I found appropriate. Thank you for all your teaching. Okay, good. You are very welcome. All right. Okay, are there instructions for learning your meditation? For re-entry after the bell. for leaving your meditation, that's what you're saying. For re-entry after the bell. re-entry is just you open your eyes, that's re-entry. You come back again. Be gentle with yourself. If you find that your meditation is nice and peaceful, you just come out gently. You can stay with your eyes closed while you get used to the noise around you or whatever. Do what feels natural. Don't force yourself out. Especially if you get a profound and deep meditation, you want to come out very gently afterwards. Otherwise, it's going to be a shock to the system when you come back into the world. Because the world is such a noisy and high-impact place. Impacts on your senses are very high, and that can be difficult to take if you have a very, very peaceful meditation experience. So just feel what feels right, right? Re-entry, stay with your eyes closed, sit in the background, disappear, pretend you're not here, or whatever. And then you should find a way, I would think. Okay. Do you have a recommended sutta reading plan to follow when studying the Sutta Pitaka? What are the most useful commentaries and resources to utilize alongside sutta study? What is your all-time favorite sutta? Thank you so much for your practice, teachings, and kindness. You are the best, Ajahn. Now that's what I like to hear. Yeah, that's right. Okay, now that's good. So, sutta reading plan. The best sutta reading plan is to read what you enjoy. And because it is setting up a plan, it becomes a bit too academic and too much like schoolwork. And schoolwork is sometimes enjoyable, not so enjoyable. So do what you enjoy. In the beginning, it's nice to have a little bit of structure to what you're doing, so you can pull the threads together and kind of see a system in what you're doing. And for that reason, it's nice to have a structured course like Bhikkhu Bodhi's In the Buddha's Words, which is structured, I call it thematically structured, can be very useful. I mentioned this already. Once you have read that book and you have read Bhikkhu Bodhi's commentaries on those suttas, then you can really start anywhere. But I would normally recommend people to start with the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length sayings of the Buddha, because it is a very varied collection. You have all the main teachings of the Buddha are found in the Majjhima Nikaya. It is often You get a bit of a feeling for the Buddha as a teacher because they're quite extended suttas, yeah? So you see the Buddha in various relations with various people, and that's actually very nice when you see that. You start to get a feeling for this character. Who was the Buddha? And that's very, very interesting. Yeah. So you have all the autobiographical suttas of the Buddha, many of them there. You have the large number of settings, a large variety in teachings. So the Majjhima Nikaya is, I think, the best place to start. You may also want to read some suttas for inspirational suttas. And very often inspirational are things like a verse. Yeah? And the favorite verse book is the Dhammapada. I really recommend you to read Dhammapada. Beautiful, lots of beautiful sayings in there. You can have it on your bedside. You go to bed, the last thing you do at night, you read a nice verse in Dhammapada and you fall asleep. Oh, you sleep so well. You're really happy afterwards. And you wake up in the morning energized, ready for the next day, because you read the Dhammapada the night before. So that's a nice place to read. I would also, nice to read, can be, especially for women, I would recommend to read things like the Therigatha, the verses of the ancient Arahant nuns. Because it is the case that sometimes, if someone is of our own gender, we can sometimes relate to it better than the opposite gender. This is by far exclusive. I don't mean to mean this in any exclusive sense, but I think it's nice to have that connection there. Yeah, just like men might prefer to read the Theragata, women might prefer to read the Therigatha, maybe. Sometimes, of course, crossover doesn't matter. But that can be inspiring. So try these various things, and then you can gradually expand your horizon, read things like the Sanghita Nikaya. Sanghita Nikaya is also a very inspiring book, especially the first book of the Sanghita Nikaya called the Saggatavagga. It means the chapter with verse. And that has a lot of... the first chapter is called the Devata Sanghita, the connected discourses on gods. on devatas. And actually, it is a very beautiful chapter because it doesn't matter whether the interlocutor is a god or not. What matters is the content that they have. So it's a conversation between someone and the Buddha, and it's said to be gods or devas in this case. And some of those are very inspiring verses again, mostly verse in there. Second chapter is called the Deva Putta Sanghita, the connected discourses on like Deva Putta, the literally, it means the children of gods, but actually it just means gods. That's really what it means. So it's kind of an additional chapter on gods. The third chapter is called the Kosala Sanghita, the connected discourses on Kosala. And Kosala here refers to King Pasenadeva Kosala. So this is like discussions between the Buddha and King Pasenadeva Kosala. Another very, very interesting chapter. Quite simple chapter, simple teachings. One of the teachings in this chapter is King Pasenadi comes to the Buddha and he comes huffing and puffing and he's looking a bit overweight and he asks the Buddha, I'm eating too much. And the Buddha says, okay, listen. And this is like the first weight reduction sutta in Buddhist history. It's true. So he asks him, how can I kind of reduce my food intake? And the Buddha said, well, this is the verse. So you get your kind of your butler, or I don't know if he has a butler, but whatever, attendant. You get this attendant to recite this verse just before you're eating every day, right? And this verse is, I can't remember the verse now. I didn't put that much attention to that particular verse. Maybe I should, I don't know. Weight reduction verse. That's kind of amazing, right? Weight reduction program in the suttas. I think it's sutta number 17 or something in that collection. There's also a very beautiful sutta there about death contemplation. It's a sutta on the mountains. And this is the sutta where the Buddha says to King Pasenadi, talks about death contemplation and the way to do that, he says, is you imagine that there are four mountains coming from the four directions. And these mountains, they're crushing everything in their path, right? And he says, what would you do if that was the case? If there was a mountain coming, crushing everything, it was coming closer and closer, what would be your reaction? And King Pasenadi said, well, if that was the case, I would do what is good. And then the Buddha says to him, well, I inform you, I declare to you, death and old age are coming from the four directions, just like four mountains. It's like, all right. It's very interesting, yeah, and powerful. It's simple, but powerful if you are not used to this kind of suttas. That whole chapter of interaction between the Buddha and King Pasenadi is actually quite nice. So check that out as well. So gradually, you go through the suttas in this way and you kind of find inspiration. I would also recommend you to listen to people who do sutta readings and explain these things, like we're doing here now, right? Listen to that online and you will often get much more out of the suttas if you do that, especially in the early days. Once you get really, really proficient, you start reading on your own, and that's fine, and even sometimes it's good to read on your own, but also get a bit of introduction by someone who is proficient with these things, someone who is also a practitioner, right? Because they are more likely to have a reasonable interpretation of the content of the sutta. So that's the useful commentaries. I would use modern commentaries, like listening to modern teachers, because reading the ancient commentaries is often too difficult, and then often they don't exist in English translation anyway. The only ancient commentary which is maybe worthwhile reading is the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification, which is a kind of a large compendium. Is it worthwhile? Maybe, maybe not. Probably not for most people, unless you're very interested. What is my all-time favorite sutta? Every sutta is my favorite sutta. I can't make any choice. This is the problem. So I think it is wrong to have maybe sometimes there are some suttas that speak to you. At another time, there's another sutta that speaks to you. It depends on your mood, depends on how developed you are, depends on where on the path you are, all of these things. So it's always changing. What is your favorite sutta? And that's the way it should be. But if you ask Ajahn Brahm what is his favorite sutta, he would probably say suttas on the jhanas, suttas on non-self. That's kind of where what he really, really gets, because that's kind of what he does. He just goes back to his room and just blisses out. That's kind of his practice. But I think that is a good point. I think many suttas that have a positive appreciation of the Dhamma, I think, are maybe some of my favorites, because I often feel that we make the mistake in the Buddhist world of focusing too much on the negative aspects, on the dukkha, on the problems. And a lot of people in the world think that Buddhists are incredibly pessimistic and negative people. And sometimes they have a point. Yeah, sometimes we are a bit pessimistic and negative. And so, but the Dhamma is not really pessimistic and negative. The Dhamma is just, it depends on which sutta you take out. And the reason why people find it pessimistic is very difficult to understand. If when the Buddha talks about the first noble truth of suffering, and he says in brief, the five aggregates of existence, the five khandhas are suffering, that's a very profound teaching. It's only something that can be appreciated by insight. So when you tell that to ordinary people who are not Buddhist, of course they're going to reject it because it doesn't make any sense. It really only makes sense when you have a deep insight into the nature of reality. And so for this reason, we should give teachings like the sequence of happiness in meditation practice and these kind of things. Because that is actually something we can relate to. Everyone knows the meaning of joy, to some extent. We know less happiness versus more happiness and these kind of things. What is your favorite joke from Ajahn Brahm? this we can get shaky territory here. Some of these jokes are not very politically correct, they're really dodgy jokes. So what is my favorite from Ajahn Brahm? He tells so many jokes. I think you better ask Ajahn Brahm that one, because he can probably have a full joke night and just tell one after the other. I'm not very good with remembering jokes. That's kind of one of my weaknesses. Or maybe it's a strength, I'm not sure. But Yeah, and I think I'll pass on that one. So, but it's a good, interesting question, but I'll pass anyway here. So, okay. Can anyone say you are their teacher here? Like you say Ajahn Brahm is your teacher here. How does someone officially become a teacher student? All right. So, I would not really recommend you to take anyone as your teacher, because really the Buddha should be your final teacher. You can tell, I mean, yes, there are people in the world you will relate more to, you feel more inspired by, and you can take them as your teacher in the sense that you listen to them, you ask them for advice and these kind of things, but don't have an exclusive relationship with anyone. It is not recommended. And it's not recommended because you never really know what's going to happen with that teacher. They may disappoint you very badly. And some people have been really, really hurt during their life by having a personal relationship with a teacher. And I think this is one of the problems of certain schools of Buddhism, yeah, where they have this idea of the guru is your teacher, and the guru is like the fourth refuge, yeah, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and guru. That's madness. That's really wrong from a Buddhist perspective. And I don't think we should emulate that or go in that direction in Theravada Buddhism. We should avoid that sense of personal relationship between a teacher and a student. You're always very welcome to come to my retreats and listen to my talks and even ask me questions, but please don't see me or anyone as your kind of, you know, personal teacher in that sense. I don't think it is recommended. So that would be my way of thinking about this. I think this is a kind of wrong path of going down. Your final teacher should always be the Buddha. If you have any doubts about what the teachings are about, and if there is a teachers are contradicting each other, the Buddha has the final word in what you should be following and what you should be doing. And that is not easy, because sometimes you might disagree about what the Buddha actually said, but at least we have some kind of standard by which we can measure everyone else. So that's kind of what unfortunately, that's the best we can do. And then we will still have to argue a little bit sometimes about the Buddha, but at least we have some kind of foundation on which to make decisions. So it is true, I do say that Ajahn Brahm is my teacher, and he is, but he's not my only teacher. I also see people like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi as my teacher, because I learned so much from him, from his translations and things. I just visited him in Truong Yang Monastery on the way up here. I went via his monastery just to pay my respect to him and to say hello. Hello, hello, okay, bye. he's another, he's a wonderful human being and very learned in the Dhamma and things. I must admit, with Ajahn Brahm, it is because I'm so close with him, obviously, it's a very close relationship. But it is not exclusive in that way. And if I see the Buddha disagreeing with Ajahn Brahm, I will confront Ajahn Brahm. Yeah? And that is what a good teacher should be like. A good teacher should be someone you can confront without having any fear about it. This is another important thing. So please don't be... If I make you fearful, I have failed in my job as teacher. I hope really you don't feel afraid of me in the slightest degree, because it would be a terrible, you know, bad consequence of what I have done here or whatever. So I really hope that isn't the case. Anyway, that's all I will say about that. So let's go on to the next one. In addition to bowing three times to the Buddha, are there other rituals important in the practice? A ritual is important if it does something positive to your mind. If a ritual you do has a positive impact on you, it makes you more peaceful, it makes you more glad and joyful, then that is a ritual you should do. So that ritual could be listening to chanting, it could be doing chanting, If you feel a bit restless before meditation, you can listen to some chanting or do chanting. Then if that helps you, good, do that kind of ritual. Bowing down to the Buddha is another one. Using anjali when you want to kind of be respectful to someone, that can be a nice ritual. It's like a ritual as well, if it makes you feel good. And if it makes you feel that it develops a kind of respect for, and you can even do that to your fellow Buddhists, right? If you go to Thailand, people do anjali to each other, because it's just a mutual respect between friends. And that's a beautiful way of kind of showing respect to your friends in the Buddhist community as well. So anything which enhances your mental qualities and faculties is a good thing to do. But don't overdo the rituals. Sometimes I think it is it's a common problem, too many rituals, and without really asking whether they are doing anything useful. That is a downside with rituals. All right. Do you advise meditating with eyes open or closed? It depends what kind of meditation you're doing, but if you want to do the real meditation, eyes closed. So it depends on where you are on the path, but if you want to do mindfulness or breathing, it's very hard to do with eyes open. There's just too much information coming in through your eyes. You won't be able to focus. You want the sight, the sense of sight to turn off. This happens in meditation. There comes a point when it turns off completely and it's kind of gone and it's disappeared. That's really where you want to go. If you feel tired or whatever and you feel that having your eyes open is good for your mental state, it works for your mental state, then you can have your eyes open. Remember, everything is measured by its effect, whether it's good or bad, right? There's no such thing as things being right or wrong in their kind of in their nature, especially not with these kind of things. It's they're measured by their effect. And if you feel that something has a positive impact on your mind, it makes you peaceful, it leads you in the right direction, mindfulness is improving, good qualities are going up, bad qualities are going down, then you are on the right track. And that is a very useful general idea on how to make any decisions about anything. Should I meditate eyes open, eyes closed? Should I do more ritual, less ritual? Should I have this job, should I have that job? Should I get married to this person or that person? Should I become a monk, should I not become a monk? Should I become a nun, should I not? Should I, whatever you do, it's a very useful kind of rule of thumb. If you think what you are going to do is going to lead to an improvement in your good qualities and a decline in your bad qualities, that is the choice you should make. So let's say that you are looking for a new job. So what is that job going to do to you? What are the people like in that company? Are you going to be so stressed that you become a bad person? Everyone, if you have too much stress, we start doing bad things, right? That's just the nature of stress. And so you ask yourself, is it going to be useful for my practice? And this is a very powerful way of thinking about life, because once you think about that, it means that you are putting the spiritual practice, you give that priority over everything else in your life. Everything else falls in under the spiritual practice. You have decided what is really important in life, put that at the top, everything else falls in place under that. So that everything you do kind of gains meaning through the spiritual practice. So this is how you can make choices in life, right? Another way to make choices, because this is about choices, I suppose, a little bit. So another way to make choices is to ensure that whenever you're going to choose, or you're going to decide about something, make sure your mind is clear when you make a choice. Never make a choice or decide on anything if you feel upset about something. Because when you are upset, you are blind. Remember that. When you're angry, you're blind. You have no idea what you're doing. Don't make any choices. Don't speak to anyone. Go and hide in a closet. Wait till you cool down, then come out. Then kind of make choices or whatever. If you feel a lot of strong desire for something, don't make choices. You're going to make bad choices when you have strong desires. If you feel deluded, restless, confused, don't make any choices. Wait till your mind is clear. When you feel at ease, you are relaxed, the mind is not restless, the mind has a balanced state. You know that sometimes, you meditate And suddenly your mind falls into the right place and you feel really good about yourself. Okay, now is the time to decide. And then you will often know straight away, that is the right job. Should I do that PhD or should I not do that PhD? Yeah, that kind of answers, that kind of comes out. Should I keep that job or should I not? Whatever it is that we want to do in life. And often it is obvious, once the mind is clear, you know straight away, the intuition kind of tells you straight away what you want to do. So should we follow our intuition or should we follow logic? The answer is that you should follow your intuition and your logic when your mind is clear. When your mind is clear, there is no defilements in your mind, then intuition is accurate, logic is also accurate, because it is the defilements that distort the mind. So things will generally be accurate, regardless of what you do, when the mind is clear. If the mind is defiled, logic will be used, the defilements will use logic in their service, right? And they will distort the whole logical process. Intuition will also, the defilements will use intuition again in their service, and they will distort what is right to do. So all decisions should be made when the mind is really clear. The last way to make decisions, this is Ajahn Brahm's way of making decisions. He says you take a coin. Have you heard about this before? Yeah, it's a really cool way of making decisions. Okay, head or tails? Okay, if it's heads, I will do A. If it's tails, I will do B, right? Flip the coin. Dung, 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 dung. Okay, what is it? Is it heads or is it tails? It's heads. Oh no, not heads. Okay, tails. That's what you follow. So the idea is to give you an emotional reaction to what is happening, right? And then you know, because it becomes like immediate. You get an immediate emotional reaction to things. So it's kind of different ways of doing, of making decisions. All right, next one. Dear Ajahn, can you please suggest strategies for turning empathy into compassion? I'm one of those people who gets paralyzed by empathy, e.g. homeless people, horrors on the news, and thank you. Yes, so how do you turn empathy into compassion? I guess by wishing them well. Yeah, you wish them well rather than just tuning into the feelings. You wish these people well and you make a kind of determination that you will help whenever you have the opportunity to do something. So, for example, when you see a homeless person, bring that compassion out. Actually, I wish you well. I want you better. And then you give them something, whatever that might be. Because precisely that is how you bring out that compassion. So another way is to turn off those news. Don't watch those news if you find that if it gets paralyzing. So try not to put yourself in a situation where you kind of find that too much of the empathy kind of comes up too much. Try to move from the passive mind that has empathy to the active mind, or the mind which wants to help, which is more kind of directed towards solutions. The solution-based mind is the one that is not paralyzed. Because when you see solutions, you see hope. Empathy is just feeling. It's kind of a hopelessness to that. You just feel the thing without having any solutions. There's a hopelessness to that. And that is, I think, why it kind of paralyzes people. But when you look for the compassion, you're actually looking for solutions. I am going to help. I'm going to do my best. May you be well and happy. And you know that there are solutions in the world. That's kind of the point. People are temporarily in those dire straits, but eventually they come out of those things again. And this is what is, I think, so interesting. When we see wars on TV, it looks terrible. It looks really, really bad. People are dying. All kind of horrors are happening in places like Ukraine or wherever it is. But what it looks like and what it actually is often two very different things. And so often we take the wrong end. We take the wrong end of the stick when we see these things, because one of the things that, and this is something I've talked about many times before, those of you who have listened to me before will know these kind of stories, but these are the stories of people who are in the war zone and they feel more happy in the war zone than they did before the war started. And it's one of those paradoxes of happiness, right? How can that be? And the reason is because in the war zone, all the ordinary things of the world, all the sensory things in the world, your house, your family, your job, your enjoyment in the world. You haven't got food. Food is rationed. You don't get clothes like it was during the Second World War in Europe. And it probably was even here in the US, probably there was limitations on things because of the war. And so the world outside isn't so interesting anymore. But instead, people have more compassion, they have more understanding, they have more, they're helping out, they're working together. We are cooperating for once. Wow, we're cooperating, working together rather than shouting at each other, whatever it is. And people, the spiritual qualities come out in people in difficult situations. And because the spiritual qualities come out, they feel more happy than they did beforehand. And of course, the lesson from that is that the spiritual qualities are far more important to make you a happy person than the things in the world. And once you come out of that war zone, or once you go back to ordinary, you forget that. And everything becomes about worldly happiness again, about careers, about amassing goods or friendships or status or whatever it is. Even though we should remember the lesson from the war, actually, the spiritual qualities are far more important for our happiness than the worldly things. And that is kind of the paradox of these war zones. And when you start to look, next time you look at the war zone, look at it with fresh eyes. Yes, there is suffering. Yes, there are parents who lose their children, children who lose their parents. And yes, that causes suffering. But sometimes they may be good people who die. If a good person dies in Buddhism, they have a good rebirth. So that is not so sad. Of course, if a bad person dies, okay, well, then they have a bad rebirth, but maybe they would have had that anyway. So dying is not such a tragedy. It is how we live that is the tragedy if we live badly. Dying is just part of this continuum, right? You die. If you die well, you live well. You carry on well. If you live badly, whatever, you die, you go on badly. But the death is just one process among many processes. Death is not so important. The worst part is the people who are left behind, the people who don't get good advice on how to deal with death. Yeah, the parents who lose their children, the children who lose their parents, the spouses who lose each other, and this kind of thing. That is the most difficult part. But the actual death itself, maybe it is not such a bad thing. So it is a much more nuanced picture than we often think. So next time you look at TV, look on this, see the news, try to change your perception of what is going on. Don't tell too many people in the world what you're doing because they think you're crazy. But this is a way of understanding things in a different way. Very often the way we look at the world is actually very contrary to what the world actually really is like. So see things in a new way. And it's interesting because, all the kind of anxiety that there is in the world now, especially among the younger generations, and how do we deal with that? And, one of the problems with all that anxiety is a feeling of helplessness. The world is going in the wrong way, and there's nothing I can do about it. I'm kind of just watching this train wreck. The train wreck is happening, and there's nothing I can do. I'm just part of this train wreck, and everything is going wrong. But that is the wrong way of thinking about life. It isn't a train wreck. The world is out of control. Forget about the world. There's only one train wreck that matters. And that doesn't have to be a train wreck. And that is your inner life. Don't make your inner life a train wreck. That is where the future is made. And once you remember that your inner life is where the future is made, that is where you kind of make this beautiful train, turning it around, going in the right direction, away from that cliff where you're going to have a train wreck, instead going to the beautiful sights up in the Swiss mountains or something like that. Yeah, they have some beautiful train rides in the central Europe. That is where you drive your train, right? It is about your inner life. That is where your future is built. So it is not hopeless. You are not helpless in this world. In fact, we are, each one of us is an author of our own future, of our own destiny. Yeah, why? Because it is how we live that matters, not so much what happens in the world. Sure, what happens in the world is going to affect us, it's true. But by building up inner qualities, you gain the resilience and you gain the future good rebirth also as a consequence. This is a very positive way of thinking about life, right? And then when you think about life like that, you don't feel so helpless anymore. You feel more joy in your existence, and it actually increases your ability to help the world. That is the paradox, right? Because then your energy comes from the inside. You become more positive. Then you can do something for the world. And the world may still go down the drain, but that's another matter. The Buddhist humor. Please feel free to kind of come back on anything I say. And yeah. All right. Okay, I'll just carry on then. So a few more questions. Dear Ajahn, we spoke a lot about thoughts on ill will today, but mostly in regard to other beings. What teachings do you or the Buddha recommend for ill will that comes up when with meditation objects, uncomfortable body or breath? Should we use a similar focus on the good and not dwell on the bad approach? Yes? So be very careful with that, because this is a problem in meditation, that you get ill will towards the breath, right? That's a very bad idea. You come to hate the breath, basically. Yeah. And this has happened with monastics I know. They've been meditating for years, given bad instructions, and never really getting anywhere, and that's a really bad idea. And this is why I say, don't go to the breath immediately when you start meditating. Forget about the breath, leaving to one side. If the breath is there straight away when you meditate, because that happens when you're used to watching the breath straight away, okay, in that case, let the breath be there, but don't make it important, right? It is there, but kind of don't even worry about it. Just go for feel the feelings in the body, enjoy the peace, allow the mind to settle down. Don't worry about the breath. So leave the breath aside. Wait for things to calm down. Allow the mind to gain a degree of clarity and peace. And then, only then, do you go to the breath. Because this whole idea that we are often taught of going straight to the breath actually goes against how the Buddha taught these things. Did I mention this the other day about the Anapanasati Sutta? Yeah, the kind of the sequence of things. Just to remind you again, according to the Buddha's teaching on mindfulness of breathing, yeah, he says that, first of all, you go to a secluded place. So this is, I guess, pretty secluded. It's a beautiful place here. We're far away from the city, nice nature and all of these kind of things. Beautiful day today, by the way. Beautiful blue skies, nice sunlight. Really attractive out there. And that's okay. You're allowed to enjoy nature, right? That's kind of the one thing we are definitely allowed to enjoy on the Buddhist path. And so you find a suitable place. Now you are here. Then you sit down, you set your body in a reasonably nice position, quite straight. Yeah, even that doesn't have to be, even that isn't that important. You can start off leaning against something, and then the body straightens up when you're ready. And then you establish mindfulness. Establishing mindfulness comes first, then comes the breath meditation. This is how it is in the suttas, again and again and again, all the time. So don't go to the breath, first of all. Learn to relax. Use the idea I said at the beginning about just resting in an armchair, right? What does that feel like when you rest in an armchair? It feels just relaxing, right? You're not doing anything at all. So sit in that armchair. And while you're sitting in that armchair, it's like you're on that train, just observing passively through the window. You're not the driver of the train. You are a passenger on that train. And just allow things to flow, yeah? Passively, yeah? Not doing anything, yeah? Waiting for the breath to appear. The idea of with waiting for the breath to appear is, again, to minimize the doing. If you go to the breath, that means you are doing the meditation. You are approaching the breath, holding on to it. So the idea of waiting for the breath to appear is the idea of just minimizing the doing. That's really the purpose of that. It's just a skillful way of thinking about it, yeah? So as long as you're waiting, you're not doing anything, that is the right approach here in meditation. And then, when eventually the breath comes, it will be easy. If it is not easy and is not comfortable, let it go. Take a step back. Learn to see the beauty in the breath. Contemplate something inspiring, yeah, whatever that might be. This is why we have these recollections on the path. Yeah, the recollections of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, morality, generosity, and the devatas. Also have the Kalyanamitta recollection. The fact that you have good spiritual friends. You can have the gratitude idea. You can just allow the joy to come naturally. Whatever it is that gives rise to wholesome joy is a positive thing on the path. And you merge that with the breath. You can have metta for the breath. Yeah, doing a bit of metta, if you're able to do that, may all beings be well. And you're able to feel that feeling. Yeah, then that too can be added to the breath. Yeah, so make sure you have a really good relationship with the breath. The breath is your friend, not your enemy. Yeah? And then you're on the right track. Yeah? All right. So let me see if I answered all your points. Yeah. Okay. All right. So now we have the second last question. The last one is still waiting down here. I have listened to a number of Ajahn Brahm's talks. On several occasions he has referred to his kuti as a cave. Does he really live in a cave? Are the caves around the monastery? Yes, he does actually live in a cave, but it is a man-made cave. Actually, it's a monk-made cave, to be precise, not monk-made cave. And this was one of the monks in a monastery. He decided many years ago, I don't know, 15 years ago, maybe something like that, he wanted to build a cave to his teacher, Ajahn Brahm. So he built him a cave. And this was a German monk. And he was like super perfectionist. Yeah? So that cave is just amazing cave that he's living in. You know, and Germans are famous for being perfectionists. They have the kind of the best engineering in the world, right? German engineering, okay, you know, is top notch. This is like a German engineered cave. And it's really amazing. He got this big load of granite rocks, this large rocks from a local quarry, got it shipped into the monastery, right? And he had this incredible procedures, and he built up this thing, yeah? And he reinforcement iron and a ton of concrete on top and earth over that. And when you go into this cave, it's a beautiful, really, really beautiful place. And it has a nice cork floor, nice lighting, of course, in there, and a nice kind of flow of air going through. But it has a steady temperature all through the year, which is what caves are about, right? Steady temperature, no noise, no light, pitch black when you go in there. If you come to Perth, ask for a tour of Ajahn Brahm's cave. There is such a thing, right? And sometimes Ajahn Brahm says, you know, one of the things I don't like about these tours of my cave is all the perfume smell that is there afterwards. Or aftershave smell, I don't know, whatever, perfume, aftershave, whatever. And that's kind of the downside of having tours. But Ajahn Brahm is very easygoing with his cave, yeah? People come from around the world asking, where is Ajahn Brahm's cave? We want to see Ajahn Brahm's cave. Okay, go and see Ajahn Brahm's cave. And one of the monks is a tour guide to the cave. And inside the cave, there are like bats on the wall. Yeah, people have bought bats for Ajahn Brahm. You know the story, Ajahn Brahm tells the story. He loves the smell of bat poo. You know that? Because Ajahn Brahm, when he was in Thailand, he used to stay in caves, and those caves were full of bats, and they're stinking of bat excrements, right? Because the bats, they just do their business everywhere, and it's kind of filled with this filthy stuff. But after, when your meditation is very profound, the most filthy smell becomes beautiful, because your mind is so positive. So Ajahn Brahm had this idea, wow, bat poo, wow, so beautiful. So he wants bat poo in the cave. And so what happens is that the builder of the cave, he tried to import bat poo from Thailand into Australia, but it was considered a biological hazard. So he was not allowed to import bat poo to Australia. And he thought, maybe there's a way of smuggling in the bat poo. And people were saying, if you do that, you're going to go to prison. And he thought, wow, that's extra bonus, right? Go to prison, nothing to do, just meditate all day. Yeah, maybe that's the way to go. No, we actually gave up on that idea. So what we have instead now, we just have some toy bats. Yeah, so he has some toy bats. He has a kind of bat which kind of looks a bit like a bat, a kind of furry bat. And then he has a cricket bat. Because he's British, so he has a cricket bat and he has a toy bat. And then after...
was it possible to import? Yeah, they couldn't import it. They couldn't get it. So now, he's grieving because he has no poo bat poo in his cave. Yeah, I feel sorry for Arjun. It's not the same, you know. Kangaroo poo is very kind of organic. It's a bit like grass. You know, it doesn't smell very much. It's too nice. It doesn't have that kind of nice aroma, which of bat poo. That is the, what happens with these things that is in these caves, yeah, then every now and again we have auctions because we need to raise money for something, and then auctions are nice because that really engages people, yeah, so we kind of get some excitement. And then things that have been in Ajahn Brahm's cave, they really kind of, that really gets the price up because they have the juju, right? Is it the juju, the vibes? And so people will bid for these things, and often they will bid lots. Yeah, like Ajahn Brahm's meditation cushion was once bought by someone in Hong Kong or something for $30,000, something like that. Yeah, that's kind of this is how some of these things go. So that's the secret to how we raise money sometimes in these places. It's part of how we have kind of this, we make things go around, as they say here. So yes, there is a cave, and it can be visited, but it is also the only cave in the monastery. We only have one man-made cave. So although Ajahn Brahm, he loves caves, and he would have liked to build more, we still only have one. But our kutis are built in such a way that they feel a bit like caves. Our kutis are double brick walls, and then we have windows, and we have shutters on the windows. And when you're inside, shut everything down, it feels a little bit like a cave. Especially the ones that we have built recently. They have built to a very high fire standard because the fire danger is so great. So when you go in there, it really has a kind of cavey kind of feeling. So there's another reason for you to come to Perth. Check out Ajahn Brahm's cave. Right. Okay, so now let's come to this last one. Okay, so let's go start again from scratch. So my question revolves around the goal of the path and the meaning this brings to your life. It may take a little back and forth to get to the heart of it, though if you're open to that. If so, there's time. So let's talk a bit about that. Yeah, the meaning of life, the thing you start to realize about your human life is that it is run by craving and desire. Everything we do is ultimately comes from that. Yeah, you get up in the morning, the reason you go to your job, the reason you choose a certain breakfast, the reason we choose a certain partner in life, almost everything we do it because we're driven by some kind of craving, some kind of desired state, somewhere we want to be. And so we're kind of moving towards the future always. Then we start to realize that we are always moving to the future. We never actually arrive. There is no arrival to that future. It's just more desire going on and on and on. In your mind, that craving, the desire is still lying to you that you will one day you will arrive. If you get that right relationship, then you're going to be in business. It's wrong. There is no such relationship. There is no perfect relationship. And so the craving keeps on lying to you, and we keep on buying into the idea that there is some goal with this craving, there is some state where finally you will be happy. But it never comes. There's always more craving. It just keeps on going, 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 and there's no end point. And there comes a day when you start to realize maybe there is an alternative way to finding contentment and happiness in this world. If craving is just forever perpetuating itself, then that is obviously the wrong path. So maybe I need to look in a different direction. And this is where you start to understand why the Buddha's teaching is the answer to the meaning of life. And you start to understand that there are other kinds of happinesses that are not involved with craving, right? And this is kind of what the Buddhist path is about. And when you start to feel a kind of joy, for example, a spiritual joy in your meditation, you realize that that kind of spiritual joy has very little to do with craving. It is immediate. It is right here in the present moment. It is not about some future desired state that never actually arrives. It is immediate here and now. And the deeper you go in your meditation, the more peaceful you are, the greater the stillness and tranquility, the more joy and bliss you experience, the more you feel that there is nothing more to desire. The mind becomes completely still. And the less there is to desire, it means that there is no future state that you're aiming for anymore. And ultimately, when you reach a state of full samadhi, where the mind is completely immobile, there is all desires, all cravings are gone. You're perfectly content and happy in the present. It means that there is no more future for you. The future has become uninteresting. The mind is no longer moving towards anything. And because you're not moving towards anything, it means you have found the meaning in the present right here. So this is this idea of the meaning of life, right? It is actually discoverable. It's one of those things that was really astonishing to me when I was a young monk, and I started to understand that actually the Buddha has the answer to this age-old conundrum of the meaning of life. There is such an answer. And I thought that was kind of weird, because all the philosophers of the world have been contemplating this forever, and usually most people, they give up on the quest for the meaning of life because it seems unattainable. But here is someone who has found it. How come we don't know about this? What's going on? We're obviously not marketing ourselves good enough again, right? There's a marketing problem in Buddhism. We need to get any marketing professionals here. take you on board, and we'll kind of help us with kind of getting this right. So we need to market ourselves better. We have discovered the meaning of, we've got the meaning of life, for goodness sake. On tap, you just have to kind of get in there, exactly, use it. And so this is what I started to understand. And then, of course, you start to do the practice. Now, for this to work, your practice has then to match that kind of evolution that you see in the suttas. It actually has to give those kind of results. And so for me, as long as the path has been going in one direction, and I've been feeling that suffering is declining, happiness is going up, bad states are going down, good states are going up. As long as I have seen that trajectory in my life, I know I'm fulfilling the path and I'm moving towards the absolute meaning that is available on the Buddhist path. So this is what I mean by, first of all, having confidence that the Buddha actually taught the meaning of life, and then the feeling that you are actually moving in that direction yourself. And then ultimately you may reach that state of samadhi, and then you realize, well, that samadhi is not the end point, because then you come out of it again. Oh, I'm out of it. Okay. So now suddenly the craving returns. So then you need something more. And that is where the idea of insight comes in, of understanding the nature of the mind, so that the craving never returns again after that. It is not just a temporary disappearance due to samadhi, it is a permanent ending due to real insight on the path. Then you find the real meaning of life. You've found the end point. Yeah? You're perfectly satisfied here and now. And that is what it is all about. So this is what I mean when I talk about the monastic life being the ultimate meaningful life. All you are doing, everything is geared towards finding the meaning of existence and discovering that through your own practice. How could it possibly get more meaningful than that? Please. Yeah.
The idea that you can commit yourself and you have the conditions to dedicate yourself in this way. And how you described it makes sense from an individual kind of psychological or like individual experiential perspective.
Mm.
But then I can think in lay life, you know, like to develop good qualities. And And if the ultimate purpose is to be able to get to a place where you can provide benefit to the world, like sometimes I wonder, I feel like maybe that's, I'm better positioned to do that in a lay context. So I wonder, like...
The best context to be a benefit of the world is to be a monastic, yeah? The Buddha was a monastic. You know, what is the main Buddhist in world history? Is it the Buddha or is it some kind of layperson? Who had the most impact in the history of the world? The Buddha had the most impact because it was a monastic. So the thing is that you can only really be of real impact if you have a deep insight and a deep understanding of these things. And that is far more likely to happen on the monastic life. As a monastic also, because you are fully dedicated to this life and practicing it fully, you tend to have more authority, right? This is just the nature of things. And I, you know, not trying to blow my own trumpet or anything, it's just the way things work, in a sense. And because you have more authority, you're more able to reach more people in the world. And, you know, someone like Ajahn Brahm, he reaches millions of people in the world through his teachings and things because of that. So there's two answers to that question. The one is that in lay life, you are less likely to actually reach the depth of meditation and insight compared to being a monastic. And that, for that reason, you would be less effective in helping people. And secondly, as a monastic, you also have, it's actually easier to be a teacher for the world, usually, than it is for as a layperson.
Yeah. There seems to be a pretty important role for the lay.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's not going to happen. Not everyone's going to become monk, right? So it's. It's one of those questions that are kind of theoretically kind of interesting, but in practice are never going to happen because it's just not the way the world works. So I would say that it's not, doesn't matter. But if it did happen, if everyone did become monk, well, then you would have to think about things in a new way, right? But because it isn't going to happen, you don't have to think about things in a new way. So, yeah. Please, yeah. Yeah, please.
I had a kind of similar samadhi experience. But in, like, in a dream, coming off a dream, or like in this very dreamy or sleepy state, but it was very powerful.
Uh-huh.
And my question to you is, like, and I had it like a couple of times, but I cannot have it meditated. Why does that happen? What do you see of dreams? And
okay, how did it happen?
No, why do you think that happens? And is there a relation? Is it like it's still very unconscious to me?
What was the context in which it happened to you?
I had the experience, it was amazing, that complete cessation of desire, of what you were just talking about now, that I had landed in a place that was absolutely, I was completely fulfilled.
This was during meditation?
No, it was in a dream.
In a dream?
I was also waking up, at 6 a.m.
I see. Okay.
It was like just I hadn't done anything, or I meditate regularly, but it was just a normal day for me.
Okay.
I was actually traveling.
All right.
I was in Costa Rica. It was a very beautiful place.
Yeah, okay.
I was in a lot of nature. But it was just like, I shouldn't be chasing that. But it never happened like when I'm
meditating, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that sounds wonderful. And sometimes, you know, sometimes we have these little glimpses about things, you know, and however those glimpses happen, they are a spur for the practice. So you should feel very lucky that you had that experience. Just like people who have ghost experiences feel lucky that they had ghost experiences. And whatever, get a bit of joy in the meditation, you should feel lucky about that. So whatever you get, see it as a gift. Yeah, it is a gift for you. And now your job is not to recreate the experience. I think this is one of the biggest mistakes we do, is the idea of recreating experiences. Because every experience is different anyway. Yeah, you may have a joy experience during meditation. The next time it may be a slightly different kind of joy. Or you may have an experience of metta or compassion. It may feel different. The experience you had is probably very unlikely to happen in the same way because it happened under very special circumstances. Don't chase that experience. Just practice the path and see what happens. And you're going to have something else is going to happen instead. So this is so chasing experiences is a very bad idea on the spiritual path. You put in place the causes, then things happen. You never know what is going to happen. And because you don't know, there's no point in having expectations, because you don't know what's going to happen anyway. You can't have expectations, right? And this is then the way to put aside the expectations. And then when you put those aside, that is what allows things to happen. Because the expectation is going to block any kind of experience. Yeah, not just the one you're expecting, but any other kind of experience as well. You won't even be able to enjoy the meditation. So put all that aside. Just be kind. Yeah, just be friendly. Just be compassionate in the world. Sit down and watch your breath. Just enjoy the tiny bit of peace that you get. Whatever it is that you get, enjoy that. And don't forget about any expectations. Then gradually, occasionally, when you're lucky, when the conditions come together, something may happen. But don't expect it. Yeah. Please.
Coming back to this idea that monastic life is the accelerated path. Ideally, people would be monastic. So say there's someone who wants to be a monastic, but there are monastic rules that prevent certain individuals from ordaining.
Yeah.
So for those individuals who really want to be monastic, but are unable to, what advice would you have for them to live lay life in the most monastic way possible?
I think it's just a matter of again, it's easy to come from an intellectual point of view. It really depends on the layperson, depends on where they're at in the practice and all these kind of things. It is not like a one-size-fits-all thing at all. So you look at the path, you look at where you are, and if you are a good meditator, for example, you already, meditation is going really well, then maybe you can live a very secluded lifestyle, yeah? Maybe you can be a staff member here at BCBS, right? This is quite a nice place to work. Or you can have some other lifestyle, like this lady I know in Australia who just lives by herself on a large property. She lives like a monastic, right? But she's a really good meditator with really profound insights on the path. So it depends where you are on the path, what is the ideal for you. If your meditation is not so good, then maybe you will choose to live a more life more with a community around you. Well, working here would be fine, right? But it may also be that you are a layperson who already has obligations. Maybe you have a family already, right? Then you have to look after those obligations. You can't just kind of leave people behind either. So it all depends on the context and the situation where you are on the path. But the main thing is that you have the Noble Eightfold Path, you practice that to the best of your ability, especially the foundational things, right view and morality. Yeah, this is really where all the effort is. And then if you are not a good meditator yet, then even if you are a layperson, it will happen, right? Because the path is the same for everyone, whether you're a layperson or a monastic. Yeah? So you just do your best with the situation you're in.
So what do you tell the so-called bad meditators in the monastic community?
Well, it's like everywhere. It's the same kind of advice, yeah? And so a monk who is having trouble with a meditation will say exactly the same thing. Yeah, okay, you work, you meditate to the best of your ability, you contemplate things, yeah, you develop your perceptions, because developing perception is really just developing right view, is seeing the world in the right way. And as your perceptions develop, as you start to see the world in the right way, as you give up the coarser defilements and attractions in the world, as you build up good qualities of metta within, it will come, it will happen. So that's what you tell them. And sometimes if you are, very restless, do more work in the monastery, yeah? Kind of help out more, okay? Some monks are workaholics, maybe I'm one of those, I'm not sure. But And so you do things. I mean, like myself, I have translated the entire Vinaya Pitaka. It's like 1,200 pages of Pali text, right? It's a lot. And obviously that has been taking quite a lot of work. But you kind of incorporate it into your general monastic kind of trend of doing things in a good way. So does that answer your question? Yeah, you sure? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, good. So anyone else want to say anything? Yeah. Yeah, please. Yeah, you please go first. Go.
You mentioned making a determination to do such and such. And I really don't understand kind of adhikana and making a determination and intention and what that's really about and how that fits in with right effort, you know, and I'm just kind of confused.
I wouldn't normally recommend people to make a determination, maybe only in very exceptional circumstances. It's not really mentioned in the suttas as anything important, you know. It's kind of very much a side issue. So you just decide, I'm going to live with kindness. That's kind of a determination, but it's not really a strong determination. You decide, okay, I'm going to live with kindness. I'm going to do my best to be kinder. So is that a determination or is it not a determination? Who knows? It doesn't really matter what we call it, but you just do the right thing. Yeah. And so there are kind of inclinations of the mind, if you like, and if you want to call those determinations, well, it's really up to you what kind of vocabulary you prefer to use. Everyone, you know, words mean different things to each one of us, so we have to choose our own words that kind of work for us, in a sense. But it's kind of strong determinations where you kind of decide, I'm going to do this regardless of what happens. That is a bad idea. And the reason why it is a bad idea, I think, is because you end up going crazy sometimes if you do that. You know, people will say, I'm going to determine to sit for 10 hours straight without moving. And some people make this kind of determinations that they destroy their knees. All kind of bad things happen as a consequence. You go psychotic maybe, or who knows what happens. You need to be flexible with how you practice the path. You need to always monitor what is happening, yeah, and then make changes. If you have a determination, it means that you are giving away that flexibility that sometimes you require to change course because things are going wrong. Yeah. So that's why determinations are not such a useful thing, in my opinion. The idea of living morally and kind, maybe that's as close as you can get to a determination, right? So, because that is very rare, that being kind is wrong. Yeah, even if you have to be assertive, you can still be kind in a deeper kind of sense. You happy with that?
Yeah, I am. I've never really gotten to the idea of determination. Yeah. You know, it never felt that good. Aspirations.
Aspirations. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know what the aspirations.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I didn't know whether I was kind of off base with it.
No, I think you are a good Ajahn Brahm disciple. Yeah. Ajahn Brahm will be proud of you. He will agree with that. Please.
I'm settled with the idea that only monastic life is the highest level of spirituality.
Is the what? I haven't said that. Haven't said that. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah. I think that in many lay jobs or occupations, the spirituality can be, the leading way.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's not my intention to say that at all. Spirituality will enrich any kind of life, make any kind of life better. And any kind of life can all move in that direction. All I'm saying is that the Buddha laid down the monastic life for a reason. Yeah, there is a reason why there is a monastic life. If lay life was as conducive to the spiritual path as the monastic life, there would be no need for the monastic life. There is a reason why it is laid down. But I need to say that sometimes there are lay people who are incredibly impressive, and many lay people are more impressive than many monastics. Yeah, and I think, wow, good on you for practicing so well. Deepa Ma and many others that I know personally, yeah. So it is not as easy as to contrast lay people against monastic, not at all, and that is not my intention. So the point, really, if monastic life is lived really, really well, yeah, then that monastic life will probably bear the highest fruits. And that is why normally you will probably find, on average, you will find more people who are enlightened in monastic life than in lay life, because it is kind of most geared towards the spiritual path. But if monastic life is not lived all that well, then it may be completely useless, may even be counterproductive. And then it's much better to be a lay person who lives well rather than to be a monastic who lives badly. So this is very important. Thank you for bringing that up, because I'm glad I got a chance to clarify that, because that is not my intention to say at all. And sometimes you are in lay life and you don't have a choice, yeah, because you have been there all the time. You have certain commitments, there are certain things that kind of you have to carry on. There may not be any good opportunities to live the monastic life. And so then you make the most of whatever life situation you are in. Absolutely. Yeah. All right. Any last, final questions, comments? No? Okay. Wow, you're all quiet. Okay. So let's turn on the projector again. David, would you mind doing that? So make sure we get it right. And now we can do the Arahang Samma Sambuddha together, now with the text projected on the wall now. Oh, okay. Oops. Oh, there it is gone. All right. Are you ready, everyone? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay. Cool. Are you able to say these words? Try. Okay. Okay. I'll just turn this one off first of all.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.